Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Yeah, there were two separate handouts, so anybody who didn't get any, get both. The newcomers, did you get the handouts? Okay. Yeah, they got already. Okay, today we will be taking a look at Sutta number 52 of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Attika Nagara Sutta. The title means the man from Attika. It actually means the man from Attika Nagara. Apparently, Attika Nagara was the name of a city or a town, and this was a person who came from that town. His name was Dasama. Dasama means the tenth. He must have been the tenth child in the family, so they just called him Dasama, and that became his name. The very beginning of the sutta is interesting, and there's a little subtext to this. Sutta begins, "Thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Venerable Ananda was living at Beluvagamaka near Vaisali." Anything peculiar about this beginning? Yeah. Excuse me? No, I mean, thus have I heard. Every sutta begins with, thus have I heard. Yeah, but even suttas in which Ananda appears and the Buddha appears, they always begin, thus have I heard. But I think Venerable Shinsheng mentioned that there's no mention of the Buddha. And why is there no mention of the Buddha here? There's some implication.
Is it after the part of
Nirvana? Exactly. That's sort of what's suggested. Of course, we don't know for sure, but generally suttas that begin mentioning the name of... You see, even when a sutta is spoken by another monk and the Buddha doesn't appear at all in the sutta, but when the Buddha's alive, the sutta will begin, "Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at such and such a place." Then Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks thus, and it's just Venerable Sariputta speaking. But still, when the Buddha is alive, they mention where the Buddha is at the time. But when the sutta begins, "Thus have I heard on one occasion," it could be the Venerable Ananda, or on one occasion the Venerable could mention some other monk. You'll never see a sutta that begins, "Thus have I heard on one occasion the Venerable Sariputta was living at such and such a place." Why is that? Exactly, yeah. Because Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Moggallana, both of them, passed away before the Buddha passed away. They both passed away, I think, a few months within about a year before the Buddha passed away. Okay, so when the sutta begins, the Venerable Ananda is living at a village. It's called Beluvagamaka. And this is near a famous city, big city, popular city called Vaisali. This was the capital of the Lichavi Republic. The Lichavis were the people who lived in this republic. It was a republican state, not a king, not a monarchy. And they were a Kshatriya clan, that is a warrior clan. And Vaisali was a very prosperous city, very highly developed in all of the arts, all the different types of crafts. Okay, and on this occasion, this householder named Dasima, who comes from some place called Uttakanagara, we don't know anything else about it, had arrived at Pataliputra for some business or other. Pataliputra is now called, it still exists in India, by the name of Patna. It later became the center of, I think, of King Ashoka's empire. It became the center, the capital city of King Ashoka's empire. Okay, so when this householder arrived in Pataliputra, when he finished his business, then he went to a monastery that was there. It was called the Kukutarama, which means the chicken's park. And he met a certain monk, and after some conversation with him, he asked where the Venerable Ananda was now living. This householder must have been maybe fond of the Venerable Ananda. He might have met him before, or else he must have heard of Venerable Ananda's reputation as having been the personal attendant of the Buddha. And so this monk told the householder that the Venerable Ananda is now living at Beluvagamaka near Vaisali. Okay, and so when the householder had finished his business in Pataliputra, he went to the Venerable Ananda. Then after paying respects to him, he sat down and he asked him a question. And very often, when householders visit eminent monks, they ask them questions that are concerned with how to live a virtuous, wholesome life in the world. What can we do to get merits? How can we acquire wholesome karma? How can we treat our wives and children, our wife and children properly? How can we, who are the right fields of merit, so that we can acquire meritorious karma that will help us gain a favorable rebirth? But this householder asks Venerable Ananda quite a profound question, which leads right into the very depths, the very heart of the Dhamma. So he asks Venerable Ananda whether there is any one thing, ekadhammo, one Dhamma that has been proclaimed by the Buddha, wherein if a monk dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed asavas, the taints, the influxes, the defilements, come to be destroyed, and he attains the anuttara yoga kama, the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. And so this man from Uttaka Nagara is asking whether there is any one practice that can lead directly to the highest realization, the highest fruit, something that will lead to complete liberation of the mind, to the destruction of all the defilements, and to that ultimate goal of the spiritual life. And all of this is put in a way by saying that, qualified by saying that the unliberated mind comes to be liberated, the undestroyed taints are destroyed, and the supreme security of bondage not attained before is attained. He seems to be asking whether there is any way that one can go all the ways directly in one shot from the stage of a worldling to the stage of arhatship. As I explained last week, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago. Usually in the progressive development in the Buddha's teaching, the early Buddhist way of development, one goes through these successive stages, the four stages: stream entry, once returning, non-returning, arhatship. Well, what's very common, it seems, in the early suttas is for a disciple to go from the stage of worldling to the stage of stream enterer, and then to go from the stage of stream enterer to the stage of arhat. But to go from the stage of whirling to the stage of arhat, all in one shot, is something very rare. But it seems, the way I would understand it, like that is the point of this householder's question. Of course, by following the same method, one can go through the sequential stages one after another after another. But I think it's the way I would understand it. What's in the back of the householder's mind is there one way that one can go all the ways up to the fourth stage, the final stage, without even passing through the intermediate stages? Okay, and so Venerable Ananda says that there is one thing. Okay, and so what is this one thing? And now Venerable Ananda explains by way of the jhanas. And so he starts with the formula, standard formula for the first jhana. Secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, that is, removing oneself from the five hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, the monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, the first meditative absorption, which is accompanied by vitakka and vichara, applied thought and sustained thought. Also, I now translate, by thought and examination. Though vitakka here is not really thinking the way we ordinarily understand it, but it's application of mind. And vichara is examination, keeping track of the object. And then with this rapture and pleasure, rapture and bliss that arise through seclusion or separation from the five hindrances. Okay, that provides the base of samadhi, of concentration. And now, in order to develop insight, the monk is going to examine or investigate this jhana and investigate it very sharply from the standpoint of its conditionality. This seems to be an extremely concise, very compressed way of developing insight, rather than taking the jhana apart into the five aggregates and investigating each of the five aggregates, rather than investigating it in terms of the different constituents of the jhana. He just takes the jhana as a whole and understands it, sees it, that this jhana is something conditioned. It's something conditioned, and volitionally produced. Here these two Pali words are quite important. Yeah, even the translation, not quite adequate. You see, the word sankatang, without the prefix, is what we would translate conditioned. But when they put the prefix abhisankatang in front of it, and join it with abhisanchetayitang, it has more the sense of something that is produced, mentally produced. So we say it's, the first jhana is conditioned by mind and volitionally produced. Or maybe the first jhana is mentally concocted and volitionally produced. That's, I think, a good rendering. Mentally concocted and volitionally produced, or even mentally fabricated and volitionally produced. Because everything, all visible phenomena, all apparent phenomena are conditioned. The cup is conditioned. My eyeglasses are conditioned. This piece of chalk is conditioned. But the first jhana is conditioned in a different way. which, and that's what's being signified by this abhisankatang. It's something extremely blissful, very rapturous. And so if one doesn't understand it correctly, then one will develop a liking for it, an attachment for it, and to misinterpret, one will misinterpret it, take it to be some kind of permanent self, some kind of revelation of a permanent self. That was what was taking place within the Brahminic tradition, where the forest meditators were also attaining jhana-like states, but they were taking these jhanic experiences to be revelations of a supreme self, the Atman. But the Buddha examined these jhanas and found that they're just mentally created phenomena, things brought into being through the work of mind, produced through volitional effort. And then one understands that whatever is mentally constructed, mentally fabricated, and volitionally produced is impermanent and subject to cessation. It's anicchang nirodha dhammang. And now Ananda says that if this monk is steady in that, if he can hold firmly to that insight into the impermanence of this conditioned and volitionally produced nature of the jhana, it's possible that he'll attain the destruction of the taints, the destruction of these fundamental defilements right on the spot. However, it's also possible that while he's engaged in this contemplation, a subtle liking for that experience will enter in, a subtle attachment to it, and delight in that experience of understanding, of penetration, and that liking for the experience, that subtle attachment to it, creates a kind of disturbance that obscures the clarity of insight and prevents insight from carrying through fully its penetrative function. And in that case, one does not attain the complete destruction of the taints, but still, because the insight is very deep, very strong, one destroys, one eradicates the five lower fetters, and one becomes a non-returner, an anagami, one who will no longer take rebirth anywhere in the sensuous realm of existence, but will take rebirth spontaneously in the form realm and attain final liberation, final nibbana there, without ever returning from that world. What are the five lower fetters? It was 2 weeks ago, a week, a long time ago. Oh, let's get them in this. Excuse me? No, we have to get them in proper sequence. Though I often get the second and third mixed up myself. Excuse me? Okay, first, identity view, that's the view of self in relation to the five aggregates. Second is doubt.
Attachment to rites and rituals.
Yeah, attachment to rites and rituals, or sometimes called wrong grasp of precepts and observances. And fourth is sensual desire. And fifth is ill will. Okay, so those are the five lower fetters. Okay, so if one destroys only those five lower fetters, but one can't destroy the five higher fetters, then one becomes a non-returner. So then the Venerable Ananda says, this is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, and so on and so on. Actually, what's interesting, I just realized this, even though Ananda is saying this is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, but this exactly, these instructions are not stated anywhere else in the suttas in as coming from the Buddha himself. It's only stated here in one other place in Anguttara Nikaya as coming from Venerable Ananda. But of course the instructions are perfectly in accordance with that of the Buddha. But this seems to be an original explanation by Venerable Ananda. Okay, then paragraphs 5, 6, 7 repeat the same thing based on the second, third, and fourth jhanas. Okay, now, starting in paragraph, and so when we come to the end of paragraph 7, though Venerable Ananda is saying, this too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, but we've even gone beyond one thing, but we've already come to four things. That is, one can use any of these jhanas, any of the four jhanas, as a basis for samadhi. And with that basis of samadhi, one can then develop that insight into the conditioned nature of the jhana, the volitionally conditioned nature of the jhana. And from the volitionally produced nature, one gains insight into impermanence and cessation. And why different jhanas are used, I guess because different meditators will be able to develop this effective insight. Let me put that differently. Different meditators will need a different degree of concentration, a different strength of concentration in order for that insight to become effective. Some can gain it just on the first jhana, others go to the fourth jhana to attain it. Okay, Ananda doesn't stop with the fourth jhana, but now in paragraph 8 he's going to introduce still a different approach. Here he brings in, or starts to bring in, the four meditative practices which are called, in the commentaries they're called, the four Brahma-viharas, the four divine abodes. They're also called the four immeasurable states, the four infinite states, because they're developed immeasurably towards all beings. And though we've gone through the four divine abodes in earlier classes, but I never made up a table for them, so just this evening I decided to go through them by way of a table. It makes it very easy to grasp when you have it laid out in the form of a table. One could see, when you just have the names, loving kindness, compassion, sometimes it's difficult to understand what is exactly meant by each one, what is the difference between them. When it's laid out in the form of a table, then one could see what each one means, what are the subtle differences between them. Okay, so the first is called metta in Pali, which we usually translate or often translate loving kindness. It's based on the word mitta, which means friend. So one could also translate it friendliness, but to my mind, friendliness is just too much of a common quality, whereas loving kindness has a deeper meaning. And the way metta is formally defined, it's said to be the wish, the deep and sincere wish for the welfare and happiness of all beings, oneself and others. And each of these divine abodes has what is called a near enemy, that is a quality which seems similar to itself, but is colored by some defilement. And so it's really different. And then a far enemy, which is the opposite or opponent of that divine quality. So the near enemy of loving kindness is personal attachment, you say worldly affection, the kind of love which involves clinging and possessiveness. And its far enemy is ill will, hatred, aversion. And loving kindness is really a foundation for the next two divine abodes, compassion and altruistic joy. Because in order to feel these two qualities, one has to sincerely wish for the welfare of others. So then when one is wishing for the welfare of others, and they are afflicted with suffering, then one sympathizes with them in their suffering. And that sympathy with the suffering of others, that is compassion, karuna. it said in the commentaries that compassion is the quality that makes the heart of the good person tremble with the suffering of others. And compassion is said to promote the aspect of removing suffering, because compassion is what motivates one to take action to alleviate the suffering of others. The near enemy of compassion is worldly grief. That is, when one has attachment to somebody, this worldly affection, and then that person undergoes some misery, especially if that person dies, then one feels grief. But that grief is not really sorrow for the other person, but usually it's sorrow for oneself, because one is deprived of the company of that person. Of course, if one feels grief when others close to oneself suffer, one shouldn't blame oneself. It's only natural. But we just have to recognize this quality for what it is. And then the far enemy of compassion is cruelty. That is, cruelty is that state of mind by which one wants to inflict suffering on others, by which one takes pleasure in inflicting suffering on others. Okay, the third divine abode is altruistic joy. The Pali word is mudita, which taken by itself can mean simply joy. But in this context, we have to understand it that it's a state, a mental state that involves relation to other beings. And so it's explained by the text as joy produced by the success and good fortune of others. And so when others undergo success, have good fortune, or have good qualities, instead of feeling envious of them and resenting their good fortune, then one rejoices in it. One feels happy that they succeed. That rejoicing in the good fortune of others, that's the meaning of mudita. Okay, the near enemy of mudita is called worldly joy. This is when people getting together, having a good time together, laughing, joking, singing together, and everybody thinks that they're all sharing that their affection and love for each other because they're just enjoying together. But that's not really this mudita or altruistic joy. And then the far enemy of mudita is aversion, that is, feeling discontent when others succeed and meet with good fortune. Okay, the fourth divine abode is equanimity. This is called upekkha. Now, upekkha, equanimity, is explained as impartiality towards living beings. It means not having preferences or favoritism, not making distinctions or discrimination, but looking at all beings, and for us humans, especially other people, with a mind of equality, not having favoring this one and having any kind of diminished appreciation of somebody else. Sometimes outside interpreters of Buddhism think that Buddhism takes equanimity as the highest goal, and then they interpret equanimity to mean indifference or just cold neutrality or cold apathy or indifference. But that's a misrepresentation. And in fact, it's said that the near enemy of this upeka is this dull indifference or apathy, this kind of worldly indifference of simply not caring. This is called the apathy or indifference which is born of ignorance. And the far enemy of equanimity is attachment and resentment, having special favoritism, having partiality, favoring some and resenting others. Any questions on the four divine abodes? No questions? Okay, then we can go back to the sutta itself. In paragraph 8, here Ananda is using this standard passage, which actually comes from the word of the Buddha himself, that the monk, how he develops this loving kindness, first he radiates it. And this is not the gradual instruction for developing loving kindness, but this is describing a monk who's already gone through the elementary step-by-step instructions and is now radiating the loving kindness to the different quarters or directions. First one quarter, then the second, then the third, the fourth, above, below, around, and everywhere. All as to himself, he pervades the whole world with a mind of loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And now when this loving kindness is developed as a meditation in this way, it can lead to a samadhi, a level of samadhi which corresponds to the jhanas. In the early suttas, we don't find the Brahma-viharas actually explained as states of jhana, but the commentaries say that one develops the Brahma-viharas to the level of the first, second, or third jhana. And the fourth Brahma-vihara, equanimity, is developed to the level of the fourth jhana. And so this loving kindness, when it becomes immeasurable or infinite, is a state which is really a jhana-like state of concentration, of deep meditative absorption. And one dwells in it for a long time until one is fully immersed in it. And then after one becomes very familiar with it and has mastered it, then one emerges from it and investigates it in the same way. This deliverance of mind, this liberation of mind through loving kindness is, again, abhisankhitam, abhisanchetayitam. It's mentally fabricated and volitionally produced. But whatever is mentally fabricated and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. And again, if he is steady in that, firm in that, able to sustain this insight, hold it clear, unflinching, then he directly realizes the eradication of the defilements, the destruction of the taints. But if there's some subtle attachment to the experience, some subtle delight in that experience, then that creates this interference or disturbance that dilutes or weakens the insight. And so instead of reaching the final goal, the monk winds up a non-returner. Okay, and so the same method goes for the development of compassion, development of altruistic joy, and development of equanimity. Okay, now we've gotten through 8 methods. Now, with paragraph 12, Venerable Ananda introduces still another methodology. Now he's going to introduce, I got 2 of the 4 divine abode sheets, but not the formless. I thought, okay, maybe I could see if I could reproduce it without even looking at it, but I won't test. Okay, so now Venerable Ananda introduces the first of the formless meditative attainments, and he's going to explain the same method with regard to 3 of the 4 formless meditations. But I've made up a table which has all 4 of them, so we can go through all 4 of them. I don't think I've ever gone through them systematically, and I didn't make up a table of them previously. Okay, so we can go through them one by one. The first of these is called the base of the infinity of space. Okay, now how is this attained? To attain it, one first has to master the 4th jhana, using as an object a kasina. A kasina is a disc. It begins as a disc, which then becomes a mentally visualized circle. It can be a circle representing one of the 4 elements, earth, water, fire, or air. I don't know how the air element would be represented. Or it can be a circle representing one of the 4 primary colors, blue, yellow, red, or white. Okay, after one gains the four jhanas based on, let us just take a blue kasina, then one has to extend the kasina, that is to widen the kasina, so that this colored form, this colored circle that one is inwardly absorbed, visually absorbed in, mentally absorbed in, expands and expands and expands till one makes it extend boundlessly so that it covers the whole visual field. So one is completely engulfed in this experience of blueness. And one is now absorbed in the fourth jhana on an immeasurable blue kasina. Okay, then to proceed from the fourth jhana based on this immeasurable blue kasina to the base of infinite space, one first considers that this fourth jhana, though it's very peaceful, it's still somewhat defective because it has a form object. And one considers that a meditative attainment without any form would be much more peaceful. And then one makes the determination to reach the base of the infinity of space. Then what one has to do is mentally remove the color which is occupying that space, to sort of mentally roll up the color of the colored kasina and cast it away. And when one removes the colored kasina, all that is left is that boundless space that the color, that the kasina was occupying. And so the base of the infinity of space is this meditative attainment which takes as its object this space perceived as infinite. In the formula that we have in the sutta, in paragraph 12, it said that this is attained with the complete surmounting or transcending of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact. There's no sensory impingement here, no involvement of an actual sense faculty. And there's no attention to any perception of diversity, no variations in perception. One is simply aware that space is infinite, and in this way one enters and dwells in the base of infinite space. Okay, then the base of the infinity of consciousness is the next one. After one masters the base of the infinity of space, in order to go on to the base of the infinity of consciousness, one now takes as one's object the consciousness that was pervading, that it had occurred pervading space as infinite, the mind that was aware of infinite space. You see, when one was in the base of the infinity of space. The mind was there, aware of infinite space. And so one now turns the mind back to become aware of that state of mind that was conscious of infinite space. And that state of mind that was aware of infinite space is experienced as infinite. And so one now transcends the base of the infinity of space and enters the base of the infinity of consciousness. If it sounds very abstract, don't worry about it. Okay, the third formless attainment is called the base of nothingness. And this gets really abstract. In Pali, this is the akinchanyayatana. And as expressed in the sutta, this is the awareness. Nati kinchi, there is nothing. And the commentaries, Visuddhimagga, explains that the object here is the voidness or non-existence of the consciousness belonging to the base of infinite space. That is, one now becomes aware that at this time, at this moment, that consciousness of the base of infinite space is no longer occurring. It's not occurring. And one focuses upon that non-existence or non-occurrence of the consciousness of the base of infinite space. And by focusing the mind on that non-existence, non-occurrence now, of the consciousness of the base of infinite space that had been occurring earlier, then one enters the space of nothingness. And then the fourth formless attainment is the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This is not mentioned in the sutta itself because this state is so subtle that one can't even do insight on it. I just include this here to be complete. And even the suttas themselves don't give a direct statement of how this is attained. All it says is that one overcomes the base of nothingness and enters the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But the Visuddhimagga, the classical meditation manual, says that the object of this base is the base of nothingness, the third formless attainment, which one perceives as peaceful. And so one now takes the consciousness of the base of nothingness as one's object. And one perceives that consciousness as being very quiet and peaceful. And in this way, one enters this fourth formless attainment, which is so subtle, so refined, that one can't even say that it's mental factors, whether they exist or do not exist. Okay, now, all of these four formless states, they're not states of insight or wisdom. They're just states of samadhi, states of meditative concentration. But the first three can be used as foundations for developing wisdom. The fourth is too subtle to be used as a base for wisdom. Okay, so here Venerable Ananda begins in paragraph 12. He explains that one enters the base of infinite space, then one contemplates this base of infinite space as mentally fabricated and volitionally produced. And then in the same way, whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation, and through that insight, one attains either destruction of defilements or the state of non-returning. Then one does the same with the base of infinite consciousness and with the base of nothingness in paragraph 14. Okay, then we come to paragraph 15, just to finish up. When Venerable Ananda had finished speaking, then this householder from Dasama, from Attika Nagara, was very happy, and he used a very beautiful simile to express his appreciation. He says that just as if a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure suddenly discovered 11 entrances to a hidden treasure, so while I was seeking one door to the deathless, suddenly I have come to hear of 11 doors to the deathless. And just as if a man had a house with 11 doors, and when that house caught on fire, he could flee to safety by any one of these 11 doors, so I can flee to safety by any one of these 11 doors to the deathless. So we can see from this that even though this householder asked the question about how a monk might practice, but he was quite an earnest practitioner himself and wanted to use these methods for his own practice. And so now the householder wanted to make an offering to the Venerable Ananda, and so he then assembled all of the monks from Pataliputta and Vaisali together. There must have been quite a big sanghas in both of these cities. And he served them all with various kinds of good food. And he presented a pair of cloths to each monk. And he gave the three robes to the Venerable Ananda. And he had a dwelling, a living quarters worth 500 kahapanas. That was the monetary unit used in those days. Worth 500 kahapanas built for the Venerable Ananda. Okay, it's quite a good sutta. Any questions?
There are four jhanas.
Yeah.
And four formless attainments.
Yeah.
And four...
There are four divine abodes.
Then altogether there are 12.
Yeah, but you see, only three of the formless attainments are used as a basis for developing insight, because the fourth formless attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, is very subtle. So it's not mentioned here. Paragraph 14, which is the last paragraph on developing the insight, is deals with the base of nothingness, then it says that the base of neither perception nor non-perception is so subtle that ordinary disciples can't perceive the different factors within that state. It's that only a Buddha can perceive the factors in that state. Maybe Sariputta can. But for ordinary, even very gifted meditators, not possible. Yeah, even Venerable Sariputta, when he enters the fourth state, the fourth formless state, he doesn't distinguish the different factors in that state. But he can just know that he's entered that state and emerged from it. That's in Sutta number 111 on page 901 to 902.
You mentioned last in the sutta, samatha and vipassana, that is to say, in the first jhana, there is also the consideration of insight. But in commentary, after the...
this question whether one develops the insight while in the jhana itself or after emerging, I have to say now, after giving this...
Suppose in the jhana, one is not able to do the insight, but after emerge out from, then one can do the insight of probably neither perception nor non-perception. Because according to the understanding, it is also conditioned by volitional will.
I guess in that general way, one could certainly understand it as conditioned and volitionally produced. Wait, say your point again.
That is to say, because the base of neither perception nor non-perception is very subtle. That is, it is in the jhana. But when one emerges out of the jhana, one can do the insight, the reflection, and understand that is also conditioned.
Yeah. That is the way it's stated in the case of Venerable Sariputta. In that sutta number 111, he just has that very general understanding of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I guess, even though the sutta is very concise, what takes place in each of these attainments is that one does distinguish it by way of all of its factors and see how all of these factors are conditioned and volitionally produced. And in this way one understands how the whole jhana or divine abode or formless attainment is conditioned and volitionally produced. Whereas one can't do that with the fourth formless attainment. And that, I'm just thinking that it seems to me more now that one would have to do this kind of reflection or this examination after coming out from the state. Because I see with the divine abodes brought in here, if one's mind is, say, completely absorbed in generating loving kindness and compassion, I don't see how one could also be examining that as conditioned and volitionally produced at the same time, it seems like the mind would have to be working on two tracks simultaneously, and it's just too, it seems to me, too difficult to do. Yes, George.
I have a question about the divine abodes.
Yeah.
You said earlier that we aren't emphasized as a path to enlightenment.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering about how one should consider them. It seems to me in the practices for loving kindness, it's a pretty active exercise.
Yeah.
And to enter into the state of samadhi, that focus on one thing, while the exercise of loving kindness is so active.
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
How can the divine abodes become a state that's like a jhana?
When you say that loving kindness is so active, you mean it impels a person to activity?
Well, the usual exercise I've heard from consider yourself near relatives.
Yeah. 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 You mean, I see, you mean that one is using the mind discursively a lot.
Yes.
So how can it eventually lead to a jhanic state?
Yes.
Okay. You see, those early stages of using the different people as a basis and the different reflections as a basis for developing that is the method for generating loving kindness, for arousing it. But once the loving kindness starts to awaken and is aroused and then starts to become fortified, then one doesn't have to use those techniques, but one is able to consolidate it and fortify it and then just radiate it. And then the radiation doesn't depend very much on verbalization. And as one is able to radiate it, then the verbalization subsides and it becomes a nonverbal practice. And then the mind becomes absorbed in that radiation until it carries on, it develops a momentum of its own. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now and with the sharing of the merits. Oh, I have to mention for next week we will, let us take sutta number 140. This is the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. It's a very beautiful sutta. This is called the analysis of elements or exposition of elements. Okay, so let us share the merits. Akasata Chabhumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabhumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabhumata Adeva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sade Deva